New Thinking Aloud is a non-profit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.
Thinking Aloud. Conversations on the leading edge of knowledge and discovery with psychologist Jeffrey Mishlove.
Hello and welcome. I'm Jeffrey Mishlove. Our topic today is Remote Viewing 3.0. And I'm delighted to be in the studio here in Albuquerque with Jana Roga, who has come here from Germany. Jana happens to be the managing editor of the New Thinking Aloud magazine, but that's the least of her qualifications. She's also the editor of Aperture, the magazine of the International Remote Viewing Association. She is the executive editor of a wonderful new book called Foundations of Controlled Remote Viewing. She is the publisher of Center Lane Books, a new company that is sponsoring books in scientific parapsychology. In addition, she is a remote viewer and a remote viewing project manager and a remote viewing researcher. Today, we're going to focus on her remote viewing research, which is scheduled for publication soon. Welcome, Jana.
Thank you, Jeff, for inviting me. I'm very happy to be here.
I am so thrilled to be here with you. I can't tell you, just to begin with, how pleased I am with the New Thinking Aloud magazine. And I know that 90% of the work of that magazine was done by you. So I'm thrilled to be with you and very grateful for all you've done. But I realize that your wonderful work as a designer and editor is the least of your accomplishments and your talents. And today we're going to be focusing on a completely different area.
Yeah, let's say it's just my life has developed. I'm coming from the design part and now going into the next phase, maybe.
Well, you've been studying remote viewing now for how many years?
Oh, let me think. I started in 2020, so not for so long.
4 years.
4 years. Mm-hmm. It's not a lot.
Considering that I started in 1976. It seems like a small amount of time, but in those 4 years, you have focused, I guess, largely on CRV, which is the approach developed by Ingo Swann in the military. And interestingly enough, I call this interview Remote Viewing 3.0. Where I started was in Remote Viewing 1.0, and I never really got beyond that level.
I didn't start with CRV, but I ended up with CRV, you would say. I'm working with other viewers who are not utilizing a method-based approach. So CRV is a method-based remote viewing approach, and we have other ways of working with it. But this is what I prefer to do and also what I prefer to teach people.
You worked under the guidance of Paul Smith, who has been on this channel many times. In fact, the single most popular video on this channel is Paul Smith's introduction to remote viewing training.
Yeah. I studied with him. In addition, he was one of my teachers. I'm working with him now, and I really enjoy working with Paul. And I think I take a lot of his time because I ask so many questions, want to know everything and want to know everything about the background and history and technology and all this stuff.
Well, I guess it would be fair to say that Remote Viewing 2.0, which began in about 1981, 5 years after my first remote viewing experience, was the development of the CRV methodology.
CRV was, when I call correctly, developed between 1980 and 1983. Mm-hmm. And the request was made from the military unit to be able to train people who are not natural psychics.
Who were soldiers, in fact.
Yeah. So Yeah, I think the problem arose when they, from the nature of the questions they had, they could of course use natural psychics, but they didn't have a clearance to look into these topics, so they had to use their own personal. And also were interested, so from the previous research, we knew that this is kind of an underlying ability in every human. So it must be possible to use normal people. And how can we train them? How can we tell those who are not, who did not discover it by themselves, how it works to do psychic work? And then this was the point where Ingo Swann and Harputov came up with this approach that they called coordinate remote viewing back then. It's now called controlled remote viewing. It's both CRV.
Both CRV. Yeah. But they went from coordinate to controlled. The coordinates referred to the target. They were given like a number.
Coordinate remote viewing, the term, I think, was used because in the early years of research, Ingo used or wanted them to use geographic coordinates to address
latitude and longitude.
Yeah, and this is also what they did in the early years. But for some questions, you cannot really use geographic coordinates. For example, if you don't know where somebody or something is, you cannot use a geographic coordinate. And then sometimes it's misleading. If you know how geographic coordinates work, you have a rough estimate of where in the world this coordinate points. And so it can induce what we call analytical overlay. So assumptions, guessing, and increase noise.
Minimally speaking, a clever person using geographical coordinates would know, is it in the ocean? Is it in North America or Asia or Africa?
Actually, more complicated to know something than if you know nothing about your target. And then they change it, and instead of geographic coordinates, they now use just arbitrary numbers. And we still call them coordinates, and then made the transition to call it tasking numbers. Some call it target numbers or whatever. It's just a arbitrary number. Some use letters too. I think numbers are better because with letters you still have some try to find meaning.
You want something completely neutral, ideally. Say, you know, go to target X.
Right. It's probably like if I give you a phone number and tell you call this person and you don't know who it is.
We haven't really, I don't think, on this channel gone into the six stages of controlled remote viewing. We have a couple interviews with Paul in which he talks about the beginning stages and the advanced stages. We didn't break them down stage by stage by stage, as is done in your wonderful book, The Foundations of Controlled Remote Viewing, where you actually replicate the Army manual originally developed by Ingo Swann along with Tom McNear and Hal Puthoff for this training. And we're not going to go into those stages right now either, but I want to indicate they exist, and that's what I'm referring to when I say remote viewing 2.0.
Yeah, right. So this process includes a written method, a very strict protocol of how you do it. The Army manuals are out there in the world since the project was disclosed in 1995. And many people know the original manuals in this printed format, but the manuals are just, they were never meant to be a textbook or a standalone product. It was just meant to capture what they knew from the training with Ingo and then, not to lose any information. So even if you read the original manuals, I would say you still need a little bit of explanation of how exactly it works and the underlying theory and
personal guidance. And so you've been training now for 4 years. How many hours would you say you have spent in training with Paul Smith and with other instructors?
Well, I never met this calculation. So I had 4 main teachers, including mm-hmm. Paul, and then several other courses with different other teachers. When I started with my first teacher, I was just assuming what he tells me is everything. Yeah. And then you find out, oh, there's more to it. There's a history and there's a development and all these different methods we have now.
Yeah.
It's like you probably have 20 different types of methods out there.
Yeah.
And then my next conclusion was, oh, I'm going to learn them all. Yes, this is, yeah. Learn them all and then make my own, draw my own conclusions. And then I worked my way back. I think it's like a trace back from the version I learned first to the version that was before, to the version that was earlier. And then I ended up with Paul, and he's the one who teaches the most original approach, the Ingo version. And I found, the farther I go back in this way, the better it works, which is interesting because most people tell you, oh, we made improvements, right? We have new ideas, we have new conclusions, and we improved the method, and our new method is way better than the old method. And the old method is just, bulky and tedious and so on. If you only see the written transcript on paper, you may have this conclusion. If you really work it, or I can only tell for myself. If you work it, then you say, oh, it works smoother, better. And I, of course, I try to find out why. I think one part may be just the human psychology and teaching. It's a natural behavior. You take a course and then you are so excited that you understood everything. But even if you listen very focused and closely, you will never get 100% of what was said. You will maybe, if you're good, you will remember 70% or something.
That would be very good. Most people, I imagine, for example, the average person, if they watch this entire interview and a week later were asked questions about it, they might remember 25%.
Yeah, but let's say I sit here with the intention to remember everything and take notes and record everything and go out. Still, I won't be able to repeat everything in the same way. When people go out, they are excited. They want to tell other people. They want to teach. They want to spread the message. They go teach what they have learned. They teach remote viewing. And the next generation, again, gets 70%. And so you can just see what happens.
It gets watered down or modified. Sometimes, I suspect, for the
better. With the best intention. Mm-hmm. So, of course, the third generation... And they are true when they say, oh, I feel there's something missing here. I learned the original approach. There's something missing here. I go take a look and I fill the gaps with my conclusions. And this is what I think that mostly happens when they develop methods or improve things.
It's useful to realize that the original method developed by Ingo Swann and Hal Puthoff, they were paid by the government for years to come up with this method of teaching soldiers how to do it. Soldiers who had no experience with this at all, although there were, I think, an idea of how do you screen people to find good candidates.
And still we don't know if there would be improvement over years, what they did back then, if there is evolution, if there is a possibility to do it better, to do more. And we know Ingo continued researching and looking into different aspects. And still, so as far as I know, or as far as I experienced, and Still, I did not train all the other different methods, just mm-hmm. some of them. I see no real difference or no real, improvement in what later versions bring. The performance of the, you have good and bad performers in every method.
Yeah.
And the performance of the best ones in every single method is kind of equal.
Mm-hmm.
I can just say from the technology, from the CRV technology, what I experience is that Ingo's concept is pretty thorough. It's very, and this is also what I found out in the later research, that you can apply what he found to pretty much everything else in the psychic work. He may not have created a formal definition of how you write down things. He tracked down what we actually do when we perceive psychic impressions, and he was able, or they, it's not only Ingo, it's Ingo and Hal, put it together in kind of a roadmap or description that gives you guidance in what is happening right now and what do I do with my impressions. Mm-hmm. This is...
I know it's very well thought out, and I believe there is a published study or a study in the archives that Hal did that indicates that the training does improve scoring.
Yeah, they had viewers. Yeah, and you refer to, I have to remember which year this was. I should know. They had one viewer doing roughly 100 sessions without any background or training, mm-hmm. just the natural approach. And they graded the sessions on a 4-point scale from 0 to 3. Mm-hmm. So 0 was a miss, and 3 was a hit, and there was levels in between.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 22% hits mm-hmm. in this series of experiments. And then this same person trained CRV and did another 100 sessions, and now he got 66% hits.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of interesting to see. It's not that the best sessions are better than the best sessions before. It's more that the average quality of the data improves, that you always get something. Even if you don't have a stellar session, right, what you would print out and hang on your wall. But the average amount of good data increases.
Which I understand has a lot to do with recognizing what is known as analytical overlay, distinguishing between your raw sensory impressions and the interpretations that our mind naturally wants to impose upon those impressions.
Yeah. Some people say that one of the main definitions of remote viewing is that the viewer is blind to the target,
mm-hmm.
which is true, but I think the more important part is that remote viewers, and I believe it's the only psychic discipline where people recognize there is a problem with analytical overlay, with conclusions that you make about the stuff that you perceive, and we find ways to deal with it, to try to separate signal and noise and have different methods. In the generic approach, what they use at SRI, you have the interviewer, and the interviewer knows about the problem. I asked Russell Targ what his definition is and where the distinction is between just clairvoyance and remote viewing. Mm. And he said in remote viewing, you have the interviewer, and part of the interviewer's job is to make sure the viewer is not really getting on a tangent with conclusions. Mm-hmm. He helps the viewer to stay in descriptions and not in conclusions, not going to conclusions. So in CRV and in this written methods, the role of the interviewer is replaced by what this structure does for you. Mm-hmm. You are able to work solo with this structure. And I have what I tell people who are interested. We have a good example in our natural life. Our visual sense is our most important sense. Mm-hmm. And when we look at something, we have, so I'm seeing you. In my perception, I see everything around here. I see you, I see this chair, I see this room, the camera. Actually, I don't see it. And never in my life I get this full picture. My eyes, and on my retina, I have these cones and rods. My point of sharp vision is as big as a coin. Mm. Where I really see a sharp picture. Mm-hmm. And then the peripheral vision is just, it's not colors, it's more like a movement and shadowing, like gray, these black and white tones. They alert me when something is going on here, but my sharp vision is only here. So what my eyes do is that they flicker around. I have this involuntary movement. Yeah. There's accumulatory movement is the term for it. And they flicker around all the time. So my focus point changes a few times per second and moves around. And then my brain does the rest in interpolating the data and forming the full picture. Mm-hmm. So our whole life, our complete perception works this way, that we only perceive little parts and we interpolate the whole picture. And this is how we survive. Yeah. So and in remote viewing, we detect that this survival mechanism is a problem. This our brain trying to fill the picture is a problem because the data that the brain uses to fill the picture is just guessing. Mm-hmm. Conclusion from things that I already know, that I remember from memory, from things in my past experience. I cannot really get new information. I can just make conclusions. So my brain is trained to make conclusions, and now I want this brain to only give me the few pieces and leave out the rest. Mm-hmm. So the most part of the training process for remote viewers is getting used to how it feels if you leave out the rest and you feel really, really uncomfortable. You want to know what it is. You want to figure out what it is. Mm-hmm. You want to tell me a coherent story. So this training is, if we experience that for the most part, when we have a very good session as a remote viewer, we really have no idea. We feel clueless, we feel like we're off track. And we never get over this feeling. So mm-hmm. we try to get used to feeling terrible in a session because we know this is what is necessary to do the good work, mm-hmm. to have more clean data. Still, we can never have the brain completely stopping in the process. We are just designed to be this way. Mm-hmm. But we can try to know what's happening, and try to use certain processes to make it a little better.
Really, we've been talking about what I would call remote viewing 2.0. This is the CRV process. Yeah. Now let's talk about your research. First of all, to begin with, what inspired you to engage in research?
It's probably part of my nature to ask questions. Mm-hmm. When we are working operational means, so we use the term working operational when we mean we apply remote viewing for solving real life questions. Yes. Not in a training environment, not in a scientific environment, in a real life case. Mm-hmm. In a scientific or training environment, it's always that we, of course, we know what our target is that we are reporting on, and we just try to look into the process. Starting with a moment when we try to use remote viewing, or make it useful for solving questions, we are going for the unknown, which is a problem. We know remote viewing is not 100% correct. It never was. We have a good hit rate, but we know at least some parts of the data are wrong. Mm-hmm. So if you don't know the answer to your question and you just get the sessions from the remote viewers, you will not know which part of the session is correct and which is not correct.
Because you can't compare it against a known target.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we use knowns for at least determining if someone has a good or a bad day. I use one example. One of my training targets is a tower, and the tower is made completely of metal. It's welded together. There is no other material than just steel and maybe a little bit of plastic around the cables and wires, and there's an elevator inside. No other material, just metal. Mm-hmm. And this tower is my target, and if the viewer describes anything metal, he's good. Mm-hmm. You know, okay. And if he sketches how the shape is. Yeah. And there is a children's playground right next to this metal tower sitting on a sandy ground, a children's playground made from wooden beams. Mm-hmm. Some remote viewers report on these wooden beams and sketch this part, like mm-hmm. a tent-like shape. And yeah. So in an operational setting, we would know, okay, he is where he needs to be. We just have to turn him around, look at the other thing. Right? Mm-hmm. In a scientific setting, we would say it's a miss because he did not describe the target. So for operational use, it's okay if you have some indications the person is where he or she should be. Or maybe they describe this tower, but our target is two people doing something, right? Following the people. Just from the description of the two people, you would not know if the viewer is even on target or correct. But from the description of the knowns, what we already know about the site, you know, okay, we can go with it. And then the viewer is reporting something that we did not know before. For example, what are these people doing? And I know, okay, parts of the data may be correct, parts may be incorrect, we don't know. So what we usually do is we have several viewers working the same target, mm-hmm. compare the outcome mm-hmm. and see. And if they all just have this mm-hmm. tasking number, right? They don't know what the target is about.
Yeah. They're blind.
They're blind. Yeah. If you have like 3 or 5 or 10 blind people describing exactly the same thing, you can be at least we have indication that this might be true. Mm-hmm. So we would never say it is true. We just say we have a good indication that it
you
is true.
Can feel more confident.
Right. So when a client wants us to answer a question, what we do is we have a group of viewers. We let them work the same target, compare the outcome, make an analysis, and report it back. Mm-hmm. Some questions are more complicated, where you need more subtaskings. So to solve one question, you may need to have several targets mm-hmm. to look at.
Yeah.
It adds up to a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And it makes a difference if I say or if I tell the client, we can solve your problem and we need 30 sessions. In such and such way, mm-hmm. or if I tell them we need 100 sessions because I just don't ask the right questions. It's helpful for me to know how this process is functioning. Mm-hmm. And with the research, we try to find out what part exactly of this data is correct, how much correctness we have overall in the sessions, mm-hmm. and how the viewer behave. Sorry, trying to find the words in different perception channels. Mm-hmm. And turn out we have perception profiles. So we assumed we have perception profiles. This is what I think myths and rumors of the remote viewing community that people have strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And we were able to show it, through our statistics mm-hmm. that different people have a different perception preferences mm-hmm. and or strengths.
Well, for example, I'm going to give a very simple-minded example. In the field of criminology, police work, there are remote viewers who work with police to find missing people, among other things. It takes a certain personality type to do that research because the targets could be a person who was murdered, can be very emotional for a remote viewer to actually witness mm-hmm. what happened. And not everybody is cut out for that kind of work, and other people are very good at it and comfortable with it.
Yeah. Just right now, I have one project where we have for this one question, for this overlying question from the client, we have several subtaskings. One mm-hmm. task would be to describe an object. Next task would be to locate an object. And next task would be to describe an event between two people. So, and certain remote viewers do easily tune in to people. I can ask them to describe the event. Yeah. And the next one is maybe better in describing physical objects. Mm-hmm. So I would task this person on the description of the object.
Now, it's my understanding that even during the phase of military-sponsored remote viewing back in the 20th century, they were doing that. They were making an effort to determine the strengths and weaknesses of each member of the remote viewing team at Fort Meade, Maryland. But you got inspired to take it to another level with your research.
Yeah. Of course, the first thing I did is look into the history and see if somebody else found out before.
Yeah, naturally. That's the first job of any researcher, wouldn't
it? It's the first job that any researcher should do.
Yeah.
It's unfortunately not the case. Everybody does, but mm-hmm. yeah. I did not find anything. Mm-hmm. I asked Hal. I asked Russell. I asked some of the older guys and just tried to find out if anybody had done anything like this.
Mm-hmm.
And we have some like this approaches, but yeah. not exactly.
I mean, Lynn Buchanan has been a guest many times on this channel and has talked about these things and the database that he kept while he was there at Fort Meade.
Yeah, right. And he developed a very good tool which enables viewer to self-judge their session. But he also broke it down into different categories of data, but still it is self-judging.
Mm-hmm.
And for a scientific purpose, of course, you need an independent judge or analyst for doing this. And a standardized method, mm-hmm. how to. So if, for example, for one target and the viewer says it's red. For every other viewer, red should be either correct or incorrect, should be graded in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I figured I need a system behind it, mm-hmm. A database. And we made a lot of effort to create this database. We are still in creating the database. It's, it needs time and it is expensive to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I found an interim process where we are working half automated
mm-hmm.
In getting these things done.
Would it be fair to say when I talk about remote viewing 3.0 that the research that you're doing, that you have done mm-hmm. as of this point, and today is we're in February of 2024, is the first stage in what you envision is maybe a long-term, a 10-year project, for example.
Yeah, yeah. I once said it is a 5-year project, but the more I learn about it and the more I think about it, mm-hmm. we can add more years to it. So we now have examined stage 1, 2, 3 from this 6 stages approach.
Mm-hmm.
We found interesting things. We have confirmation for some of the hypotheses we had. We have shown that for this group of, let's say the sample group that we have from the viewers and their sessions, we assume that the accuracy of the data would be between 65 and maybe 80%.
Mm-hmm.
The 65% is a number that is taken from Ingo,
yeah.
That he made a claim about when he reached this accuracy level.
Mm-hmm.
It turned out we are closer to the 80% than to the 60%, which is interesting.
Well, you make a distinction, and I think we should make this clear for our viewers, between the overall accuracy rate and the item-by-item accuracy within a particular session.
Oh, and yeah, and more levels. We have an overall accuracy rate because we give, we assign, we give points.
Mm-hmm.
If a piece of data, one word in the session, again, red or cold or whatever, is correct, it gets 10 points.
Mm-hmm.
We can have data that is what we call probably correct. And this approach is, again, taken from Ingo's way of teaching that he used for in-session feedback. We have correct. We absolutely know it's correct. It is feedbackable. It is in one of these pictures or recordings. There is a probably correct where I can tell, I don't have it in my picture, but I'm pretty sure it is part of the target.
Mm-hmm.
We have a canned feedback. That means we don't know.
Yeah.
It's not a yes. It's not a no. Doesn't mean you're wrong, but we just can't tell from what we know
mm-hmm.
About the target. We have something that is near, like the playground to this metal tower is near.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell the viewer is roughly in the same area, but it is not the target.
Yeah.
Still, he gets some points
mm-hmm.
because we know he did something right. Yeah. And then we have a miss. So mm-hmm. it's a gradual approach. And then mm-hmm. you can add the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you only have, if you have 50% of your data absolutely correct, you can have more points because you have data that is probably correct or mm-hmm. near the target or so on.
Mm-hmm.
So we have this overall score.
Yeah.
We have this score for absolutely correct data. And then we found that it is possible in this, not only in the CRV approach, that a viewer mentions a certain aspects multiple times.
Mm-hmm.
If you take this into account, let's say we have this metal tower again.
Okay.
And he says metallic. And then 5-10 minutes later, he again says metallic. It's metallic. You would get a better score because you have 3 times the full 10 mm-hmm. points. So we have to extract these multiple mentions of data from the calculus.
As I recall, what you found is that when an item is mentioned several times in a remote viewing, it's more likely to be accurate.
Right. So I looked at all these multiple mentioned pieces of data and found mm-hmm. 71% of the multiple mentioned items are correct,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, just curious. Also, I found, and this is only an indication that we have so far, that if a viewer gets information about the material of objects,
mm-hmm.
like this is made from wood or stony or whatever,
mm-hmm.
The following data is more likely to be correct.
Now, I want to go back for a moment to the question of near hits.
Yeah.
Like you said, the playground that's located adjacent to the actual target, which was a tower. It reminds me, and you may not be familiar with this work, or maybe you are, Alan Vaughan, mm-hmm. the late Alan Vaughan, who was a good remote viewer and a very close friend of mine when he was alive. developed a method for training ESP. And it involved, if I remember correctly, like a clock face with a circle, mm-hmm. and there would be, let's say, 12 points along the circle. So the viewer is trying to guess which is the correct one. But let's suppose he guesses one that's adjacent or adjacent to away. He'd get partial credit for getting near.
Yeah.
And he found that that system, which was a simple computerized ESP testing program, was very effective for training, that giving people feedback that they're getting close to the target is very useful.
Yeah, not only have hits and misses, yeah.
I guess it could be related to the whole field that is known as fuzzy logic. There needs to be an additional category besides a hit or a miss.
We just applied this grading or rating system that we knew from the training, and it's working very well.
Mm-hmm.
Also, we try to figure out how we grade sketches.
Yeah.
Remote viewers do sketches. It's easy to judge a word. A word is a word.
Mm-hmm.
It's clear that this is red or black or whatever. And sketches are more in the view of whoever is looking at it. And we applied a similar system, but based on different people looking at these sketches and mm-hmm. grading them, and how much overlapping they find between what is shown in the sketch and what they know about the target.
Mm-hmm.
And it also has this 5 subsequent stages or points in it to make it comparable.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have another score. This is what I call relevance score, because you can have correct data in your session. For example, the sky is blue, or your target is a house and there is a wooden fence in front of the house and the fence is painted in white.
Mm-hmm.
And the viewer reports on this white wooden fence. It is still correct data. It's not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to know what's going on in this house, it doesn't help you in any way to know about this white, nice painted fence.
Mm-hmm.
So I added another layer of scoring, which is a relevance score,
mm-hmm.
where I say for each piece of data, is this data relevant to solve my question? Does it tell me anything specific about the target or unambiguous about my target that is not just ambience data that can be anywhere?
Mm-hmm.
And this is the third layer.
It's worth repeating. A viewer can come up with accurate data, which from an applied perspective isn't relevant to solving the problem at hand.
Yeah, right.
Although it might be useful at least to let you know that the viewer is approaching the target.
Yeah. I can tell from accurate data probably that the viewer is in the right area or wherever he or she should be. Doesn't mean that whatever he brings is useful for solving the question.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this is all what Skip Atwater tells when he's talking about the military work for their clients. That the value of the information depends on how useful the information is to solve the question.
Mm-hmm.
The remote viewers may have had sessions who are very accurate in terms of you can tell they are on target,
mm-hmm.
but they had not enough of new data that would help to solve whatever the question was. And this is also something that we are interested in mm-hmm. in the operational work.
Well, it's fair to say that during the period in which we know publicly that the government of the United States sponsored remote viewing for 20 years, I think roughly from the mid-1970s to the mid-1990s, they were doing operational work. The remote viewing teams at SRI International, SAIC Corporation, and the Fort Meade Group were being tasked typically by various agencies within the intelligence community to solve problems. And they were good enough in that era that the program kept getting renewed funding year after year for 20 years.
20 years, yeah. So, I have a list of 18 different agencies tasking the volunteers. Yeah. Some of them just for one or two projects, and some of them came back very often.
And now we're 20, 30 years past that era, and there are, I guess, thousands, I think thousands is a fair number of people who are being trained in remote viewing by many different teachers with many different approaches. And it's also fair to say, I think, that many of the different labels, ARV, CRV, TRV, SRV, that you will find from different instructors is many instructors want to have a unique label, that it's for branding purposes.
Probably. So I think there are different explanations. Yeah. One might be what I said before, that they try to close perceived gaps and make improvements. And with their improvements, they cannot name it in the way that it was before. Yeah. They have to find a new name. Mm-hmm. Other people want to have a brand and want to promote their style of doing it and their understanding. So they might be branding reasons. There might be just
in any case, where we are today is that there are also large organizations, corporations, governments, different agencies within governments that have a need for various problems to be solved that resist conventional scientific or logical solutions. And so they think about remote viewing. And I think it's also fair to say that remote viewing is still pretty controversial. They don't want controversy in their organizations. They want it done quietly.
Right. Yeah. So just from my own experience is that they know what they're doing or using, but they contract it out. And
they contract it out so that they don't have to explain in-house, you know, how the consultants arrived at whatever information they're being provided with. But in addition to wanting to do it quietly and confidentially, they also want it to be done professionally.
Yeah.
They want it to be done, you might say, at a level of industrial professionalism.
Yeah, it's hard for them to tell who is a good remote viewer and who is not. Mm-hmm. Remote viewing itself is kind of a fancy term for everything psychic. So as a remote viewer, I have a definition of what remote viewing is and what remote viewing is not. but a lot of people come with very different ideas of what remote viewing is. One of the main problems is maybe the wording. We call it viewing, but it is not really viewing. Mm-hmm. It is perceiving, and it concerns all sensory channels, not only the visual channel. And probably the visual channel at least. So you have more other impressions, even knowing.
You might say remote knowing, some people like the term perception rather than viewing, because it doesn't involve the normal senses at all.
So, for example, Paul says remote perception, or likes to say remote perception, and this is closer to the truth. Mm-hmm. It's not only perception. So, in the early stages of it is perception. Even knowing is kind of perceiving something. In the early stages, it is sensory-based or sensory-related, and it goes more into concepts and knowing in later stages. But people, a lot of people just hear remote viewing associated with being psychic or clairvoyance or all sort of stuff, and they think this is it. So you cannot really tell them it is not remote viewing, because they are just convinced that they got it right.
Well, it's a language problem.
It's a language problem,
And we don't have good language to describe something so intangible.
Yeah, we don't have the right language, and we have burned many terms. So one reason that people don't like to say clairvoyance or whatever channeling or is that they that these terms have for example in working with professional clients, they have kind of a bad taste, right? They're not reliable, some spooky things and woo-woo stuff, and it sounds better if you use scientific terms, and remote viewing has this connection to 20 years of research. And this is what they always quote and bring up, that we have this research, scientific base. For a client out there, it is very hard to decide who is a remote viewer and who's not. They don't know the difference. They just know the term. And a lot of people call themselves remote viewers. And even for us, it's hard to decide.
Well, we do have an interview on this channel, for example, with Angela Ford, who was a member of the team at Fort Meade, and in fact, one of their very best, who didn't use the normal CRV protocols at all. She was a channeler.
And she asked her entities, and
it was highly accurate at that. So
right, but Angela, so she did not CRV, but she was in this unit, and because the unit was called the remote viewing unit, now she calls what she does remote viewing, and this is just a language problem that we have. I have no solution so far. The only thing that we can do is doing good work for clients and hope that the clients recommend us, that we have the ability to at least talk about some projects. Most projects we can never talk about, and this is also a problem. People ask us for solutions or information, and they don't want to share not only how they got the information, but also what the information is. So we can never talk about the projects.
In a way, it's a shame because science progresses through open communication. It's people argued about, government secrecy, but you do have the same issue in corporations. And I can understand if I were a corporate executive and wanted to hire remote viewers, the smart thing to do would be to keep it confidential.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why invite controversy?
Yeah. Some of the people who approach us have had personal experience with psi phenomena or with remote viewing themselves.
Which is about 70% of the population.
Experiences, And some are, some tried or tried out what remote viewing is. So they know that we are talking about real stuff. Yeah, but still they can't show it. It's helpful if you have a contractor. So as a contractor, you can say, it's my business secrecy. I got this thing.
Well, I have a prediction that someday somebody's going to do a program. They'll call it Remote Viewing 4.0. And Remote Viewing 4.0 will be an era in which people can talk about it openly.
Yeah.
And the difference will be that our culture won't be so based on material science that they feel that anything that cannot be explained in terms of a mechanistic material model can't be real and must be woo-woo, and it's taboo. People will understand that matter is not the fundamental basis of reality, that the fundamental basis of reality is somewhere else, somewhere akin to what we call consciousness.
Right, yeah. I like this prediction to have the show on this channel. That means it isn't too far out.
Well, I may not be alive, but my hope is that the channel will continue after I'm gone, and the day will come. But for now, this is where we are today.
Right. And I like to be in this place. Mm-hmm. I'm really excited to make these experiences and work with these people. Mm-hmm. And yeah, still be in a position where we have the need to find out more about it.
Well, one of the aspects of your research, in addition to looking at the accuracy rates within a single session, and we've talked about both the verbal accuracy and the accuracy of drawings that a viewer might make. And I know in some instances, viewers even create little 3D models and so on. But you're also looking at the profiles of each viewer.
Yeah, this is one of the aspects that we found, that there are, in fact, perception profiles, mm-hmm. that some viewers are good in perceiving, let's say, colors, mm-hmm. visual things.
Yeah.
And the next viewer does not get visual impression right, but he's good in perceiving smells or mm-hmm. sounds mm-hmm. or tactile impression.
Yeah.
So if you know that, it adds a new quality to the previous approach in which I had one tasking, I had five viewers working the thing, compare the data. So, and then I have four people reporting on the same color and the fifth is not. Mm-hmm. So, but if I know, it makes a difference if these four people are good in perceiving colors or not.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, it adds another layer for my analyst.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if I have a certain target where I know in this task, it is very important to get information about, let's say, materials or movement, or in this target, there's a lot of energetics going on.
Mm-hmm.
I can select viewers based on their profiles mm-hmm. who are very good in doing these things.
Yeah.
And the viewers can go through this process and do a certain number of sessions, and they get their perception profile and their session profile.
Mm-hmm.
And also you can, after a certain time, for example, come back and see if there is any training progress in what you do.
I understand in your research that the more trials a viewer does that you have data on, the more their individual perceptual profile becomes clear.
Right. So an assumption would be that a training makes a viewer better.
Mm-hmm.
And what we found is that it's not quite this way, that the viewer gets better through training, but the profile sharpens.
Yeah. The profile sharpens.
Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. It gets more, yeah. It's more coherent what he or she brings in a session. We have fewer complete misses and more, so the average data correctness mm-hmm. goes up. And
when we talk about these perceptual profiles, it reminds me quite a bit of the phenomenon of synesthesia,
yeah.
where in synesthesia, a person will take a particular sensory modality, let's say hearing, and the perceptual process inside, you could say inside the brain or inside the mind, takes that input, but it can display it in the mind differently. So people who are synesthetes might see the music.
Or smell colors
like that. So, and my friend Ed May, I did an interview with him, an excellent remote viewing researcher, seemed to feel that people who were gifted at synesthesia were better at remote viewing.
Okay.
And there's some suggestion to that effect. I don't know that it's been tested very well, but it's important to distinguish between the way information appears in the mind, in what some researchers call the sensorium of the mind, as opposed to our physical external senses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is an interesting question. We could test it.
Yeah.
We could try. We have so many things that we
There's
want
so
to
many things
find out
that,
about.
That, yeah. that still could be tested. So.
Yeah, but the thing with studies is you always have to have a certain number of trials.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say 50 or 100 to even make a claim. And you only have to look into one singular aspect. You cannot combine aspects in a study. So it takes a while.
Well, that's why I assume when we talk about remote viewing 3.0, you really see this as a 10-year project.
Yeah, I said 5 years last year.
You said five.
I'm saying 10 years now.
It may turn out to be 20.
Yeah, but still it brings us forward.
Mm-hmm. Sure, because it's not as if the field of remote viewing, as much as the $20 million that the federal government spent over 20 years between 76 and 96, roughly, it's not as if that's the final word.
This reminds me of a question that my brother asked me. Mm-hmm. So when I told my brother about remote viewing and I had this book, I gave it to him to read and... So Paul had this book, Essential Guide to Remote Viewing, yes. Which is a good introductory book. And I translated this book into German, so we have a German version. Mm-hmm. And I gave this version to my brother to read it. And then he asked me, so when they founded it for 20 years, why don't we know everything about remote viewing now? And I said, okay, how many years did it take to develop rocket technology? Computers or whatever.
Yeah.
We made a start with this first 20 years, but we are certainly not coming to an end. So there's so many things. And every answer produces new questions. They did a lot of research finding out how a signal, a psychic signal, could be transmitted.
Mm-hmm.
Did studies and studies on shielding electromagnetic waves and trying to find out if there is any kind of submission. Mm-hmm. And so far, they didn't find one.
Right.
But it took years to come to this conclusion or to come to the conclusion what now the remote viewers take for granted, that we can look into the future and into the past. This is just all... an outcome of years of research that we now can...
And of course, many skeptics will say that, well, if you can't explain it in terms of a mechanism like electromagnetism, then it must not exist.
Yeah. Or maybe there's just something else, or maybe we don't need the common physical explanation.
Yeah. Well, people naturally try to interpret remote viewing in terms of, you know, what is the latest technology? Like back in the 1930s, there was the very popular book, Mental Radio.
Yeah, yeah. And all were talking about waves.
Mm-hmm.
And then all are talking about quantum entanglement. And now all are talking about simulation based on AI. And
So people will always try and explain it in terms of whatever is the cutting edge technology of their era. I tend to think that the problem goes much, much deeper than that, which is why progress is so slow, I think, in this field, is because it's cutting up against some of our deepest ideas about the way reality functions.
Yeah, you make a very good point. We have a certain need for a feeling secure about our environment.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to know, mm-hmm. not to not know things. And so we have a tendency to just stick with the next best explanation. And of course, if the explanation that we had before is not as good as the new technology, we love to adapt this. I try to maintain a status where I can say I don't know, and I feel comfortable with not knowing things.
It's so important. And I know that some of the skeptics who refuse to acknowledge any of the data take the attitude, well, if this data is correct, then everything else I know is wrong.
Yeah.
And that's frightening. That's very frightening for people. But imagine if a human civilization continues for another 10,000 years. people in that era will probably look back and say, yes, people in the 21st century mostly had it wrong.
Right. Like we say it now about previous centuries. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
We do, to a point we do. I'm inclined to think that if we go back to archaic times, they saw a lot of things more accurately than we do today.
In science, we have this problem of correlation and causation. Mm-hmm. Trying to make models is necessary, but it's not always helpful. Yeah. So if you have this correlation causation, you can make observations, but you cannot only live from observation and anecdotal evidence, because then you could say, like windmills create wind. It happens at the same time. Right?
Yeah.
And this is what we, parts of this research is anecdotal or mm-hmm. yeah, observation. And then scientists try to create models to explain and predict yeah. what would happen if we apply the same process on a different field and see if the outcome is the same.
Yeah.
And I think just human nature gets in the way where they don't allow things to happen differently than expected and try to.
But what you're telling me is that very slowly our whole civilization is changing to the point where, without naming names, it's fair to say that in the community of people within which you are operating, you're getting feelers from various corporate and government agencies where they're open-minded enough to want to engage in projects with you.
Yeah, yeah. And this is encouraging.
That it is
that
encouraging.
That we are moving and that we at least moving forward mm-hmm. something. So, parts of the communities are concerned after shutting down the military project. Of course, we are not doing psychic spy work right. here. Right? So what other fields do we have to apply these abilities? Some are looking into stock markets, finding missing people, also solving real life questions. But what we really need is, having corporate clients and government clients that they use it on a larger scale.
Well, I'm very happy to say that while you're here in Albuquerque, we'll do another interview and we'll talk more about the applied projects without breaking any of the confidentiality agreements you may have.
Yeah, NDAs are a problem, but I try to tell as much as possible.
I'm looking forward to our next conversation. Jana, thank you so much for this one.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff, and I'm very happy to be here in person after
I'm delighted.
A year of working together.
Yes. Well, thank you for being with me. And for those of you watching or listening, thank you for being with us because you are the reason that we are here. I imagine that by now, many of you already realize that in conjunction with White Crow Books, we've just launched the new Thinking Aloud Dialogues book imprint, and our first title is There Life After Death? New Thinking Aloud is a nonprofit endeavor. Your contributions to the New Thinking Aloud Foundation make a meaningful difference in our ability to produce new videos.